There was a moment's silence, in which the adjudicator looked at Clitheroe, and Clitheroe stood with his face white and his mouth set. Then he shook his head.
"I see no advantage to the court in examining this witness further," says he, and sat down.
The next thing I knew, there was an adjournment, and I was hustled off to Bailey's office with Clitheroe and Dunn, and the first two rounded on me like bears. But I snatched the ball from their hands and laced into them for all I was worth. It was my only chance, I knew, to play the mystery as I had done in the Washington Navy Department, and play it as furiously as I could.
"If you so mishandle your case, sir, that you can't get a condemnation order that a child could obtain, is that my fault? The wrong slaves called as witnesses. This fellow Anderson permitted to shut me up on the very point where I could have given conclusive testimony, and then the impudence to break the solemn assurance I was given in Washington by questioning me in a way which, if I'd been fool enough to answer, must have elicited the names I am duty-bound to conceal. And you dare to raise your voice to me, sir? Do you think I'll see 2 years of my work ruined simply because some fool of a lawyer can't win a case which in itself is nothing, nothing, sir, I tell you, compared with what I and my people are trying to do? Oh, this is too much."
How I managed to lose my temper so badly for so long when my innards were quaking, I am far from sure. They didn't take it lying down, either, especially Bailey, who was half convinced my indignation was sham, but he couldn't be sure, you see. There was just enough mystery as a result of all the bloody lies I'd told in Washington to make him wonder.
"Your conduct, sir, gives me the gravest suspicions," says he. "This is a deplorable affair. But we'll go into this, sir, believe you me, we'll get to the bottom."
"Then you'll do it in your own good time, sir," says I, looking him in the eye.
"Not in mine. I'm sick and tired of this whole sorry business. I was promised protection, sir." "Protection?" cries he, looking ugly. "You have forfeited all claims to that. My department's protection is withdrawn."
"Thank God," I exclaimed, "for all the good it's been to me. I'm better without it. I intend to place myself at once under the protection of my ambassador in Washington. At once, do you hear? And whoever tries to hinder me will do so at his peril." For a moment he looked as though he was believing me, and then we were summoned back to the court, and I sat red-faced, squeezing myself to keep it up, while Clitheroe and Anderson bandied away at each other, and finally Clitheroe made a speech, and concluded it by moving for the confiscation and condemnation of the Balliol College. The adjudicator took off his spectacles and asked, did their cases rest? They nodded, and he put his spectacles back on, and everyone stood up. The adjudicator talked for about half an hour, reviewing the evidence, while our legs creaked, and I couldn't for the life of me stop my hands trembling. Then he came to his peroration. It was short and decisive.
"It rests with the plaintiff to show that the Balliol College was carrying slaves in contravention of United States law. There are grounds for believing that she was. It may also appear that grounds could exist for charges to be brought in connection with damage done to United States property by Captain Spring. On the other hand, it may be that, after the conclusion of this court, the owners of the Balliol College may hold that an action lies against the United States government for unlawful detention. These are matters outside the scope of this adjudication. The activities of the Balliol College prior to her arrest may also be matters for a mixed commission court of the British or other governments. It is precisely for the attention of such court, if it be called, that I have mentioned the conclusion of this adjudication that grounds exist for believing that the Balliol College was carrying slaves in contravention of United States law, but I cannot hold that the grounds have been proved conclusively to the satisfaction of this adjudication. The motion for confiscation fails."
I pulled myself together and shot Clitheroe as baleful a look as I could manage, for Bailey's benefit. The adjudicator turned to Spring.
"You are free to go. As I understand it, your vessel is in the river, is it not, under a prize crew? Hear our order that this prize crew be withdrawn forthwith, and that such stores, water and wood as may be required in reason for your departure shall be left aboard, and in accordance with custom, clearance be granted for your departure this very day, or such date thereafter as you find fitting."
"Thank you, sir," says Spring. "I thank the court. I shall leave Anchorage today."
The adjudicator banged his desk and scuttled out.
and at once there was a great rush from the public benches to Spring's table, and he was being clapped on the back, and Fellows was shaking Anderson's hand and hurrahing. Clitheroe walked out of the court without a word, and Bailey, after a lowering look at me, followed him. And suddenly I was standing alone. But I doubted somehow if this happy state would endure for long. I knew I daren't stay. The spectators were streaming out now, by the entrances at the back of the room. Half a dozen steps, and I was among them. And then it struck me. The dazzling thought. It was fearful at first, but then it seemed the only safe way. I walked out into the busy street, crossed to the far side, and took refuge beneath a tree, waiting.